Call the meeting to order. First order of business is roll call. Bill Brannigan?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm here. Bob Berman. Jim Hanselman.
Hanselman's here.
Gary East?
Here.
Raleigh Escobar?
Here.
John Updike?
Here.
Robert Baer?
Here.
Dustin Capri?
Present.
Okay, new business. Derek?
Yeah, just, I'm going to go ahead. Yeah. Well, with Muni Code, really, if from my perspective, I'm just looking for if there's any feedback any of you guys have on look and feel, anything you want to make sure or have concerns about in terms of making sure when it gets implemented, you know, functionality you'd like, not down to, you know, getting into the weeds of the specific code language.
Kind of stuff.
And frankly, we're going to, as I mentioned in the memo, we're going to end up getting another review set anyway because they missed at least 10 different ordinances that still haven't been incorporated in there, and that's going to change quite a bit of language across multiple chapters. So if you don't have any feedback at this time, that's fine. But it, you know, we're in the process of, once we get through the proofs, they'll be making it available through their online library, which you had a link. You can see how their online library is structured for multiple jurisdictions. And then it'll be linked through to our website.
Yeah, what do we do with things we find that are not appropriate to change at this point, but should be at some other point?
Just email it to me directly, and I can see that it gets taken care of by the consultant.
Oh, well, no, I'm talking about actual changes to the words.
Oh, you mean actual substantive changes?
Yes. Are you going to start a list of housekeeping things?
I'm already in the process of working on a housekeeping one. Remember, we went over the outline of kind of the topic areas and kind of sidebars of what we would be including in housekeeping, because we don't want to get too, if it's a very material issue, we don't want that in a housekeeping package. We want
right.
that.
But things like duplicate scope sections.
Go ahead and send me an email.
Okay. All right.
Will theirs, like all their others, and I know Am Legal too, are the ordinances then hot linked once it's live?
That was what our ask was of them. And we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
But we asked that they include the hot links to the ordinances. So if you're going through
like
and you go, oh, okay, I see this clause. It was enacted with ordinance, blah, blah, blah. You can click on it and go there. So that's what we asked them to do. And we'll try to stay on that.
Okay. Yeah, you mean that's a link to your redline version that you presented to us and
it's going to, yeah, to the scanned ordinance. The final signed scanned ordinance. As an attachment, as the Exhibit A or Exhibit B or whatever would have the red line.
Okay.
Stuff.
Anything else on Muni Code? Okay, moving right along. Derek, item 2B, potential partnership with UO Sustainable City Program.
Yeah, they reached out. Megan Banks did. She is a professor at University of Oregon, oversees this program. The way this program's set up is that what they're trying to do is they try to align a project with multidisciplinary coursework over the full academic year. So you'd have in U of O, that's three quarters. The first quarter starts in September. Winter quarter starts in January. You know, so they could launch one of these things either in September or January, depending on the amount of work that's involved. It's a one-to-one match. They have one more year of funding available to them. I included a link in your materials. I hope you had a chance to take a look at the program, look at some of the projects that they've been involved in, how they have that set up. You know, with these, it's, you know, does it line up well with where we're at with various projects? And I think in this case it does, kind of where we're at with City Center. You know, by the time we move into the fall, we're going to be, you know, well into adoption of whatever HerbWorks, which is one of the subs, has put together. We'll be kind of refining that and, you know, beginning to implement components of city center revitalization. This upcoming year, we will be launching a 30% design, starting to work on that. That's not a piece I necessarily think is a great fit for them, but that's something we'll be doing. But in parallel with that, I think there certainly is an opportunity for them to, for us to maybe do a partnership with them to begin to engage the businesses about, you know, some of the questions about, do you want to maintain a Deco District theme, or do you want to do something different, or do you want to do something, nothing at all, thematic-wise? Are there certain consistent design themes as businesses that you want? You know, maybe, you know, all new facades have awnings of a certain size so that you, over time, get more protected walkway for pedestrians going to retail. I'm just throwing out examples. There could be a wayfinding piece to it in terms of a refreshment of wayfinding. You know,
What exactly would they be doing as opposed to staff or contractors?
Well, to be clear, they would be serving as a contractor. And the product would be something they develop over the course of those three quarters. Now, you know, depending on the nature of the project, they'll structure it differently with their courses, because it's not just planning that we're talking about. They have, you know, they have architecture courses. They've got geography courses, so you get into kind of your GIS components. So depending on the project, they'll try to align their coursework up to address it. And at the end of the day, what the students get is some real-world exposure to projects in communities, you know, that are meaningful. And so, you know, they have a, you know, my interest in bringing this forward to you is, you know, just kind of get your thoughts on, you know, what might make sense, you know, given your understanding of where we're at, particularly with that city center project, as I'll be meeting with her in, you know, in a few days, and we'll have a chance to see what we might be able to work out.
Two questions. One, how much money are we talking about for the one-to-one match?
Probably no more than $50,000. And you're talking about that all would be, that'd be Northside Urban Renewal as part of the implementation of the City Center Revitalization Plan. Okay. So,
and what did we actually get out of it? When, at the end of it, how much better off are we going to be than if we just passed?
I think we'd be better off because we're leveraging our, you know, we're able to stretch our resources more than we normally would. Certainly, we could engage professional consultants for some of this work. You know, but some of this stuff you might actually get a little bit better engagement from the businesses if they're students. You know, and some of the owners down there.
A fresh set of eyes.
Sure, you absolutely.
You know, you've got young students who are learning things, and they might come up with some ideas that our older generation might not have considered.
Absolutely, that's possible.
Who would kind of babysit with them, or the mentor from the city? Would that be you, Derek?
Yes, and or Anna, who's our urban renewal project manager, we may tag team it. I can also pull in Kathy, our grant manager, if it gets into some of the further fleshing out details of a facade improvement plan, you know, grant program or something of that nature. So we have some different staff at the city who could help with this. It would be overseen, presumably, and this is my understanding, would be by Megan Banks or somebody from U of O who's kind of coordinating on the students on their end of it.
And how much time would it take, how much time every week would it take from the city?
I don't see it as any more impactful than if we were engaging consultants or, you know, the expectation on my part would be if we come up with something that works as a project, we work out the scope, project scope, and, you know, the level of time that we're prepared to commit to it. And if it's more time than we're prepared to commit, then that would be an issue. You know, that's going to get into the details there. But I think I think we might be able to work out something where it's not too time intensive on our end, and would be a meaningful project where, you know, that would benefit Newport, which is what we're looking for at the end of the day. And, you know, from their perspective, they haven't had an opportunity to work with the coastal community. This program has, I think, 1 year of dedicated funding left. Probably not going to get renewed. It was federal money, so.
Take it while you can get it.
Yeah, exactly.
I had a super positive experience in San Francisco. I was lucky to be able to bring in the Golden Shovel contest, which is between Cal and Stanford. They do a competition. You give them a project, and then they have teams that actually compete with developments, and then they're juried. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite a big thing in the business school. And we did two of them for projects that I have, and I mentored them. And it was really worthwhile. It was stimulating because they were totally out of the box, which is what you want, right? These fresh eyes coming at it from a different perspective, and I think that's what we'd get here. And I echo the sentiment about just being sure you've got the time to be able to devote to what you promise.
And I do think sometimes that not only do the students bring a fresh perspective, but I think it sometimes when students are engaging members of the community, the members of the community are a little bit more open-minded, less guarded, more willing to share their time, because they recognize their students.
I generally support the concept, depending on the specifics, but my reservation is that when we hire a consultant, we're hiring for their expertise, that they've done this X number of times in the past. Mm-hmm. They already have their procedures as to how they approach and give them. And none of that would be present in this circumstance, but $50,000 isn't that much money, and it sounds like a worthwhile thing. That's my opinion.
I participated in something like this when I was at the University of Oregon, and I think, we worked with the city of Damascus on a form-based code for a new development. And then in the latter part of the term, we worked on designing individual buildings on parcels. And so with the city revitalization committee, I think HerbWorks is talking about implementing essentially a form-based code anyway. Mm-hmm. So you could play along that same theory. And then during the open houses, it's been really fascinating where I think some of the things we've heard most on that committee is that people are having difficulty visualizing how buildings would actually be developed in this area. Mm-hmm. So what a fun opportunity to maybe have some of these students from architecture and allied arts at the University of Oregon sort of like cut loose on these parcels and try to actually visualize like what could be done. For my part, Derek, I'd be happy to like help volunteer for reviews as a part of it. Count me in if you need help.
Is this the School of Architecture or Urban Planning or School of Dentistry? Or, I mean, who?
They're under the, School of Dentistry, but they're.
Somebody steps up.
They're under the same umbrella. Planning and architecture are under this. They're in the same school at UL. Yeah.
Well, as an educator, I think this is something that is really valuable for students. This is an opportunity for them to see real life stuff. It kind of reminds me of student teaching, where they drop you in and you finally decide, "Oh, I need a life preserver." Okay. You know, so it will give them an idea of, is this what they want to do? This is what their career is going to lead to. So, you know, we can kind of serve as a bit of an apprentice program for these kids, and I think that's super valuable. Now, having said that, I would also add that, yes, they have a fresh set of eyes. On the other hand, I've been watching my my hometown, where I was born and lived for 50-some years, and the university there and their architectural students have been flooding the planning commission meetings because of housing. And for them, the only thing they see from watching many of these meetings is that they want a second house on every lot. and they can't seem to get beyond that view. And so there's, we come jaded at every age.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what these kids come up with. And maybe kids isn't the appropriate term, but they're younger than I.
in that same breath, though, the interesting experience I had working through a similar process with the city of Damascus is they were our client.
Yeah.
And our professor presented it that way. Uh-huh. So it wasn't a, hey, you're a student, go have fun. It was,
yeah,
pretend this is, yeah, a client. You go talk to them, you engage. Like, oftentimes the clients that we dealt with who were real landowners in the area had much different views than I did. But I was sitting there going, oh, okay, this is what they want. So I need to find a way to incorporate that into a building.
Yeah.
And Bob, like, to your point on getting a good product, I think as long as it's tailored to, if it's a multi-term project, you're usually looking at what is essentially a thesis, right?
Yes.
And so at that point, you're not going to have like first year architecture students doing it. You'll have people that, and granted, like I knew very little when I first graduated university, but I knew a lot more than I did the first year, right? And so like for me, I did it during my fifth year at university. And so,
yeah,
had some practical experience with planning and architecture just through,
sure,
the years.
Sure. Well, I think it's great of the university to try to create these opportunities for their students. It's stuff that you can't just do in the classroom.
Well, it's critical. Yeah. I mean, there's precious, yeah, little grounding in reality that you have at the universities.
That's right. So,
I mean, I think Dustin would be the first one to say he didn't have a whole lot of exposure to building codes when he was an architect.
Magic Crete. That's how everything stood up.
Well, $50,000 might cover the tuition of one student now at most universities. So, I mean, this might be a deal.
Okay, is that enough to run with, Derek?
Yeah, no, I think I have what I need. I'm looking forward to the conversation with Megan. We'll kind of see if we can line something up that makes sense.
Yeah, if it comes up again, be nice to have her here.
Sure, and we may have an opportunity to share with you kind of a draft scope on that too, and get your feedback on that if we get that far, and hopefully we will.
Okay, moving right along, item 2C, draft amendment to NMC chapter 14.21, geological hazards, related to parties qualified to prepare reports. Derek.
Yes. So you had held a work session in January on this. You had a request by a firm to that the city should revisit its geo code to allow geotechnical engineers to prepare reports in addition to just certified engineering geologists. The way our code is structured, as it was adopted in 2000, I want to say 2011, Bob, is when we did the major overhaul. And that code, you know, is structured such that a certified engineering geologist has to do the baseline report. They kind of set out what the underlying geologic conditions are and have a general set of recommendations for what can and can't be done. And then if there's engineering remediation that's required, say, okay, you can make the site suitable, but you got to build an engineered retaining wall in a certain location, or you have to do a specific type of engineered foundation at that location, that's where the geotechnical engineer would get engaged, and you would have either two separate reports prepared and submitted to us or a single report with both components that are stamped off by both professionals. And so we had a discussion about that in the work session. The individual from that firm pointed out that the board of geologists that oversees certified engineering geologists allows geotechnical engineers in certain circumstances to mentor aspiring certified engineering geologists who want to take that exam. If we can mentor them, why can't we sign off on those reports? When I reached out, I included the email from the state, the representative with the State Board of Geologists. They added that mentoring provision in 2021, I believe she mentioned, so it's about 10 years after we did our code. You know, she, in reading that, you know, what I get from it is that they don't object per se to geotechnical engineers doing reports of this nature. They're just calling out that a certified engineering geologist does have distinctly different skill sets and is responsive to a different oversight board than geotechnical engineers are. Now, I've reached out to the licensing board for engineers, and they acknowledged that I reached out to them and said that they would be getting back to us shortly on that. If you look at the codes that other jurisdictions have, what you'll find is some common themes, which is normal. It's when you look at a couple of the other coastal communities that did their geologic codes the same time we did, or the same within a few years of when we did, you'll see them structured similarly, with certified engineering geologists as the one who has to do the baseline report, and then geotechnical engineers or licensed engineers could jump in if there was an engineering remediation. But then when you see a little bit more modern ones, you see that that's muddled down a bit, and geotechnical engineers are listed as a qualified professional, I think would be an example of one of the codes in here. I think that may have been Bandon's, where it was qualified professionals include, and then it includes both geotechnical engineers and certified engineering geologists. And so, you know, from my two cents, I have no problem initiating, and maybe the best thing is to initiate the legislative changes. I went into the code and modified in a number of locations where I had to modify it that would allow geotechnical engineers to be on the same footing as certified engineering geologists, is to go ahead and initiate the legislative process and then see how it plays out, see what kind of testimony we get, see if we get formal comment from the licensing authority for the geotechnical engineers and what that comment looks like. It may be that they're fine with them doing these types of reports, you know, per the geologist guidelines. It may be that they might suggest that if we're going to allow geotechnical engineers to prepare these reports, then maybe we ought to modify the report components a little bit. I think the one point that the individual who raised this made, which I think is a very valid point because we're experiencing it all the time, is they're right, there's not a lot of certified engineering geologists out there. It's very hard sometimes for people to hire somebody or even find somebody that they can hire to do a geo report. And, you know, like a lot of the different professions out there, you're seeing a lot of the CEGs that have been licensed are retiring out. We've had to remove a number of them off of our list because they're no longer practicing. And it's not being backfilled. So if we can get analysis in these hazardous areas from geotechnical engineers that's sufficient to address, you know, concerns relative to slope instability and impact to neighboring properties as a result, if you're doing development in these areas which with known stability issues, are you adequately mitigating those potential risks, not only to yourself but to neighboring property owners? If we can get that from geotechnical engineers, then I think that's great. Now, we're still taking the same tact that we do, we would be with a geotechnical engineer as we do with certified engineering geologists, which is prepare a report per those guidelines. And then, you know, if the report says it's a reasonable project to happen in this area, provided certain recommendations are met, then we require that, you know, the applicant demonstrate that they met those recommendations, or, you know, follow those recommendations through the course of construction by submitting at the end of the day a letter that, you know, from the certified engineering geologist that, you know, their recommendations were followed and they're satisfied that the end result is consistent with their original recommendations. Yeah, Bob?
It occurs to me one of the reasons you have these restrictions is because of the potential liability, and you want to make sure this is right, and that these certified engineering geologist would probably have some massive bonding associated with them if their building falls over mm-hmm. because they screwed up. Are there the same requirements for a geotechnical engineer having that kind of insurance, I guess?
You know, I could get you the answer. My suspicion is yes, and they're probably not that far off.
Well, that,
because yeah. geotechnical engineers are signing off on some pretty significant, you know, projects at times.
Key bridge, yeah.
Well, bridges, absolutely, you yeah. know. I mean, we're tied up in a whole pile of litigation on the pool. Well, you have geotechnical engineers that were involved in that are all part of that negotiation right now. So, yeah.
You know. Okay, I just to make sure that we mm-hmm. we don't end up with mud on our faces, because
I think I would urge this commission to move slowly.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard any outrage from the community saying we need to allow, you know, engineers to now do the geological reports. So what happened here is a lobbyist from the engineering group who wants to enhance the number of his clientele or his members to have jobs, they approach you, you're going out, and you find out, you know, based upon your memo, you find out that the engineering folks and the geologists, they're distinctly different disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then you say you reach on out to the engineering folks and you ask them for their input, and they haven't given you any input, and they'll pass along their response once I hear back from them. It would seem to me that after we gather all of that information, or after you've gathered it to present mm-hmm. to the commission, that would be the time to decide whether or not to initiate a change in the code. It seems a little premature at this point.
That's a good point. There's an apocryphal story in our neighborhood. I don't know whether it's true or not, but one house that was proposed to be built, they hired a certified engineering geologist. And the guy said no. They went and found a different one. He said no. Went and found a third one, and he said yes, and they built the house.
Is it falling into the ocean yet?
Not yet, but it's close. But it shouldn't have been built that lot.
Long, long time ago.
This was a long, long time ago. But the point is that it may make it easier to find somebody who would sign off when they shouldn't, if you have a bigger pool of people that can sign off.
You know, I take your point, Bob, but, you know, the Capes and Tillamook was one of those examples in the past where it was a subdivision that was signed off by a geotechnical engineer and a bunch of the homes, including, I believe, we had a Senator Hatfield who had a home that was involved in that one that, you know, took a dive down to the ocean off the bluff because the bluff peeled away, and that individual lost their license. I suspect whoever was involved with Jump Off Joe lost their license too. Point being, I mean, you're going to run into that from time to time, but they're signing their professional license. When you're doing that, you know, they're taking on a certain amount of liability when they author a report of that nature.
They're professional engineers. I mean, at the end of the day, they're not.
Right.
It's not just some random person who gets a certification.
Correct. These are people with some skill and quite a bit of knowledge relative to these issues. I think it's very real. And I take your point, Braulio, about the person who brought it up. But the person who brought it up is because they're on one of our list. We have a list that we, because people constantly ask us, we can't make recommendations. We have a list of firms with certified engineering geologists. Now, we're constantly having to update this, and some because people are retiring, they're leaving firms, blah, blah, blah. That firm's on here, but that firm that people contacted doesn't have a certified engineering geologist, but they believe that they're qualified to do some of this work. And if they're qualified to do some of this work, which is what your judgment's going to have to be at the end of the day, then why wouldn't we allow them to do it?
Do we know that they're qualified when we don't have the data from the geologist folks or the input from them? You know, and I agree with you.
Well,
I can recall back in, I guess it was the mid-80s, Remember, they were going to build something at Jump Off Joe. They couldn't get an engineer, a geologist to sign off. So they kept shopping, until they found somebody to sign off on it. And then lo and behold, what happens? Falls into the ocean. Oregon Willamette Lumber Company goes belly up because of all the materials they put into the project. I guess I'm suspicious about water and gallon qualifications.
I think the key is initiating a legislative process doesn't mean you're going to move it forward to the council. It just means that you're moving this along so that we can begin the formal process of getting it to a public hearing. And we can inform that with the information from the State Board of, you know, geologists and the licensing board for the professional engineers.
That's why I don't think it's a watered-down certification. I think it's just it's a different route to get to the same
different
certification.
Yeah, you but see,
they're doing the exact same work. It's just one's an engineer. I like I would say like dirt people versus building people, and they're still all looking at dirt, but just what their background is. You know, that's the difference between a CEG.
Right, one's more dirt.
A CEG is a dirt person, and you know, at the end of the day, a PE is an engineer that is looking at dirt from a constructability standpoint. A CEG has to do that as well. His undergrad was just more focused on like
so
rocks.
So take the Jump Off Joe situation as an example. Would the builder, the engineer, feel comfortable telling us what's going on with rock?
Oh, I think there's like bad CEGs and bad PEs, right? So. I think, like Derek said, at the end of the day, you lose your license. Like, there are people that ask us to do projects where report isn't required, but I don't like the soil and I just won't work there because I think there's too much of a risk, even though the jurisdiction doesn't necessarily require a report. So, you know, it just goes to, finding trust in a stamp, which hopefully if people are not trustworthy, they don't keep them.
Had to obtain a geological report.
Oh, I didn't tally him up. You could probably just pop in there and look it up real quick, Sherry. While you're doing that, I would draw your attention to, I included, and this is the big lengthy document, which was that 2019 publication that came out from, it says Preparing for Landslide Hazards, a Land Use Guide for Oregon Communities, October 2019. It was authored by DLCD, but had Dogami had a lot of input into it, was funded with federal dollars, FEMA. And figure 2.9 on that, it's on page 30, it's 106 of your packet, page 30 of the document. It has a diagram here showing areas of professional practice related to landslide hazards. And what you see is it starts with registered geologists who can't do these types of reports. And then it works its way down through certified engineering geologists, geotechnical engineers, and then professional engineers. And it points to two. It points to certified engineering geologists and geotechnical engineers. And it says specialists, CEGs, which are your certified engineering geologists, and GEs, your geotechnical engineers, are generally the appropriate professionals to involve in landslide hazard analysis related to proposed development. So they're saying both can do it. But the key, I think, here is what are we asking them to do as well? You know, are we asking a geotechnical engineer to prepare a report per guidelines authored by the Board of Engineering Geologists? And is that kosher if we're asking them to do that? It's not a set of guidelines they've developed, or at least, you know, hasn't been blessed by the Board of the licenses that engineers, but maybe it's okay. We'll get that information into the process. I can get feedback, and it's just going to take a little longer, but we can get some feedback from the State Board of that licenses the engineers.
Wouldn't it be wise to have that feedback before we initiate a process?
For me, it's just moving it along.
Explain to me the urgency of having this done right now at this point in time. What happens if there's a delay of a month, 2 months? Where's the injury? Where's the damage in the delay?
Braulio, could I offer a thought on this? So you make a good point. So I guess the question is, what kind of outreach would we do beyond these two organizations that are under email? How could we engage this community? And I think we're going to better engage them if we throw something in front of them to look at.
Right.
I think if we just vaguely say, hey, we're thinking of tweaking the code, that's not going to get their attention. You want their input, and you'd get it with, we're going to consider taking this action. It's not, doesn't mean we're going to take the action, you know, but I think it would get their attention.
Once we have the data, you know, what we're learning is that the engineers and the geologists, they're slightly different disciplines. And perhaps there might be some circumstances where an engineer would provide an appropriate report. There might be other circumstances where it would require a geologist to prepare the report. I mean, I think that's something we would flesh out as we generate more information.
The building code also helps with that a little bit, because it requires, like, if we do certain projects, certain larger projects with higher occupancy, you have to have a peer review of the geological report. So our clients hate it, but like we'll have to, they'll hire one geologist to do a report and provide recommendations, and then you have to have a second CEG or geotechnical engineer write, do a peer review of that report.
So if a person built a nice big home overlooking the bay,
not a home. Not a home. No,
great,
not a
black home.
Like our Oregon Department of Forestry project's a great example. Okay. So there was two engineers that, so our clients had to hire a second engineer to write a peer review report, or peer review the first geologist.
That was for
report.
What?
For the Oregon Department of Forestry.
That was a requirement of your client?
No, for the Oregon Building Code.
Okay.
Dustin, from the architectural point, how much information would a lender need before they would approve funding for a home in a suspected area?
It's funny you bring it up. So I was actually thinking this, like, how do you try to get around your concern? Because your concern is valid. Just someone's like, oh yeah, I'm a, you know, going to throw this around and just say yes on sites that may not be ideal. Can the city of Newport require professional liability insurance? A certain level? Because that was an area where I think, like, insurance companies are great at protecting themselves. They're not going to insure people that, and so, like, I think a $2 million policy is pretty standard in the industry.
I haven't seen a code yet that goes down that path, probably because, you know, I think the cities are uncomfortable throwing a dart out there saying what the appropriate level of insurance is.
Yeah.
Why are we qualified for, I mean, presumably the ones that should be driving that are their licensing boards.
Yeah.
For one, that's one that's going to be key on that, because they've got a better sense of the types of litigation that have been playing out and the kinds of awards and things that, you know, and the insurance companies themselves obviously would have skin in the game on that too.
Am I recalling correctly? I think I just read it that whenever we get a geological report, we have it peer reviewed.
Only in the active landslide hazard areas. So the most unstable areas, we have a peer review requirement. So to your question about geologic, on a busy year, it's maybe a dozen. On a slow year, you're, you know, three or four. So, I mean, that's kind of the volume.
By the way, these geological hazard area maps, they were rather crude when we did this 15 years ago or whatever.
Right.
Have they improved at all?
No.
Not at all. Absolutely not.
No. You know, and this is not to cast shade on the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. They're the folks that did a lot of the mapping, certainly the stuff on the bluff erosion side of it. They've been working those issues in other communities where that mapping didn't exist, trying to fill the whole thing out. So we haven't seen any more refined work in our area that's comprehensive in nature.
There's projects underway through Dogami or anybody to run LIDAR and update those maps?
Not to my knowledge.
Shame, because it can be a major cost to somebody to either prove they're not in a landslide zone, or if they are, get that report.
They've been investing a fair amount of time on the tsunami hazard mapping, and that's where their focus has been of late. So I'm not sure if or when you know, we're going to have state resources dedicated to improving the mapping. You know, and frankly, a lot of what we have now too is not what was originally mapped. It's a result of, you know, we had earth movement in this area, and now we've got another pocket that gets folded into it because of known instability.
It's actually a new technology that's much better than LIDAR, frighteningly so. It will probably take more property off a building. Possibility. I don't know the name of it. I was just reading about it. I mean, I'm growing too old and my brain doesn't trap as much stuff as it used to, like acronyms. So, but there is a better technology, and it's hundreds of percent better than LIDAR at showing faults and former slides that we didn't know of. And that's only going to uncover more surprises for us.
Yep.
Okay. But I will say one thing about this issue that we were talking about, these geotech engineers and the geological engineers. I had to have that for our house, and it was difficult to find someone. I don't think that's a reason to move forward on allowing more people to write these reports. And when I look at what the Oregon State Board of Geologists said, where they have allowed the evidence is kind of that geotechnical engineers with certain qualifications, they could mentor certified engineering geologists to do the job. But that's only certain ones that have a particular qualification or additional studies. And that's not spoken of. And I really think that when you're dealing with something that can have such high liability, you want the correct person to do the evaluations. I mean, that's coming from the State Board of Geologists, and I suggest they probably know a bit more about that than I do.
Well, my thought is that we ought to go ahead and initiate, because I think the draw of a public hearing, public testimony that's on the record might get us better information than just an email to an organization that doesn't have anything specific to react to.
Right.
And I would love to see a geotechnical engineer and a certified engineering geologist sitting at that table answering these kinds of questions.
What if they don't show up?
Well, that's
that you're seeking.
Well, if they don't show up, then we don't get the testimony. But we aren't going to get it if we don't initiate. We certainly aren't going to get
something
the
where there was, what is it, 2 to 3 applicants over the last year?
Yeah, that's on the low end. That's you can be on the low end, but then on the high end, we have had years where we've had double digits. So it depends on, you know, where development's occurring at any given point in time. Frankly, if you were to. Here's the deal, you know, if you don't get the information you feel you need in through the public hearings process and you don't advance it, but, you know, one thing we can do is if you initiate it, I'm thinking the kind of outreach on this is fairly targeted. You know, we don't need to carpet bomb everybody who lives in a geologic hazards area, because I don't know if they'd even be interested. That's not really, you know, we're not talking about making fundamental changes to the code in terms of what it is or isn't a hazard, or whether or not their property is going to be, you know, flagged as a hazard. We're just talking about who's qualified here. So I would, to do the reports, and I think with that in mind, it would be outreach to the firms that have done work in our area. That would seem to make sense. Or those that are on our list who may, you know, who we know could do work in our area, even if they haven't done recent work. The oversight boards for the two bodies. DLCD, which is the state agency that, you know, our codes need to comply with statewide planning goal 7, which is the hazards goal. They're the ones that authored that 2019 report. And I would think GoGAMI would also be, you know, because they did the baseline mapping. And I've already talked to them, but they haven't provided, they've not been asked to provide formal comment yet on anything. But they would certainly take a look at it. And that's Burns, who's cited in the DLCD document, and Jonathan Allen, who's our local Dogami.
Does the city still have a contract with Foundation Engineering?
We do.
I was going to think that that's a great firm right there. They're based in Corvallis. Dave is
Running,
a,
yes.
Yeah, Dave Running is a geotechnical engineer, and right. his wife is a certified engineering geologist, right. both working at the same company.
Right.
Get Dave and Brooke in here and have them talk about the difference between
well,
what
no, they
do. Well,
no, they'd be on the list of firms that do work here.
Yeah.
But there are others. Schlicker and Associates is one.
Yeah.
That's done
yeah,
a lot of work.
Yeah, Adam could come in and talk.
Dave Rankin, forget who he's with now. He bounced around. He's in a Washington firm now, I think. But he could probably speak to it. He's a certified engineering geologist. K&A Engineering out of Coburg has done work. I mean, so, but to get to your point, I think they're going to the extent they're going to engage, it's going to be on a very specific question or issue on this. Is qualifications to do the reports and whether or not how we frame what needs to be addressed in the reports influences whether or not they'd be signing off on them or not.
Well, we'll bring the initiation up for a vote in the regular session.
Okay, fair enough. I think I had your work program. I don't know if it was.
Yep.
This is right after the 300 page. I think we killed a tree here. I'll have a first cut here before too much longer for that housekeeping package for you to take a look at. I expect we'll have some of the comp plan policy language for city center revitalization coming, at least in draft form, for you to start to take a look at, along with development code concepts. I think for purposes of kind of wrapping up our work with ODOT on the city center revitalization plan, because that's got state funding in and not just our funding, so it's a partnership. We're gonna need to at least get the policy component adopted. The code piece we don't have to have adopted to satisfy the terms of the grant. So we could take a little bit longer on getting the form-based code. We may need longer to get the form-based code wrapped up. Who knows? We could end up, per our earlier discussion, having another group like the U of O students provide some input that informs whatever the final draft of the design code looks like. But that should be coming forward here pretty soon. We have one meeting of the advisory committee for the city center plan, and that's the 16th, right? 16th of May. So yes, we will have information for you by the 12th, obviously, because they're going to be looking at it on the 16th.
I would say that contractor has not been very good about producing the documents in a timely manner.
It's been a challenge. You got to have a conditional use permit hearing coming up on the 12th. That's with South Beach Church, actually. They want to have a junior and senior high school at Foursquare Church. And it sounds like to me like that's kind of, and Dustin, since they're your client, you may have some insights on this, but it sounds like that's kind of more of a quasi-permanent thing that they're looking for, that they're not going to have the capacity in the new facility they're building for the number of students that they want to be able to teach. So they need to have a satellite location.
Where is Foursquare Church?
It's the one there back behind the Burger King.
Did you just say South Beach Church?
Correct. They would be operating a school out of the Foursquare Church.
I can't on their
CP. Well, South Beach Church is using that property between Burger King and Fred Meyer Field.
Yeah.
Okay. So that'll come up. I haven't put it on here yet, but I do expect any day to get a CUP application coming in from Toyota of Newport to do a scaled down dealership. So what was originally approved through conditional use, I think LRS was the architect on that. It was a 26,000 square foot building. The new building design is going to come in at 20. So they're shaving off about 6,000 square feet and redesigned it somewhat. But they're trying to maintain the basic layout. And so the parking areas, the landscaping all looks the same. It's just the building footprints being reduced and certain components are being removed.
When does their approval expire?
It's been over two years. Well, they pulled the permits.
Oh.
So they've paid for everything. That's the thing. So we're going to end up having to reconcile that too at the end of the day. But they paid for something they don't intend to construct at this point. So
is LRS still the architect?
No, LRS is out. They got some new folks coming in who I guess their thing is car dealerships. So that's really their wheelhouse. So we'll see how it goes.
I like that design, the original one.
Mm-hmm.
Homer.
As we move into the summer, there'll be more work sessions around the city center revitalization. Stuff's going to be a fairly large package, so we'll need to work through those code amendments, and then the island annexation will happen, and we'll have a check in on that on June. And I am anticipating a submittal coming in from Fowler for an additional multifamily phase, and that'll be a Wilder, they call it phase 6, 30 plus units on that one. That's right in front of the church. So that's kind of what we have right now. Bill.
Yes.
In the coming weeks, I'll need to line up a time for you to sign a final plat. It's not ready yet, but when it is, and that's for the 9-lot one that they've been grading in. If you've been up there, they're getting pretty close on their 9-lot subdivision. I've already reviewed the draft of the final plat, and so as the chair of the commission, you're the one who gets to sign your life away on it.
Okay. Well, good for them. I'm glad they're moving ahead.
Hope you got good liability insurance, Bill.
And just an FYI, we've got the community college coming in for pre-development meeting on the 15th of May, I think, my calendar. So that's moving forward now, too. You know, the community college, it's for the vocational. They got the bond that went through. So it's going to be a trades wing that they're going to be constructing up there, so we'll be chatting with them about that.
Do we have any authority over the fairgrounds and anything the county's planning on doing there? Or are they exempt from having to talk to us?
No, they're not exempt from having to talk to us. They haven't done anything outside of some demolition work. I mean, they have a commons project. It went through a public process. They've indicated they intend to construct that project. I don't know that there's anything in that project that would make its way to the Planning Commission.
Okay.
But they do have to communicate with the city. They're going to have to get permits, building permits for the buildings. And we may have a traffic impact analysis that goes with that, given its scale. That'd be the one planning piece, I think, unless they are looking to do something that I'm not thinking of right now. So. Okay. We have committed to coordinating with them on that. You know, we have the Safe Routes project is in design right now that will make things work a little bit better on Harney. That's going to go under construction in 26. And then the state's going to follow that up in 27 with a reworking of the actual signalized intersection at Moore and 20. And then we also have funds budgeted to pave streets such as Fogarty and some of the others that tie into that commons area. So that's the urban renewal commitment, is to help with the infrastructure that'll support that commons project. But the county's really had a hard time getting off the ground with the commons project. And I don't know when they're going to start actually moving that in a meaningful way. You're awful quiet over there, Dustin.
I have lots of opinions that I'll keep to myself.
Let's take a quick little break, or can we go into this before 7?
No, just a 5-minute break.
Okay, work session's adjourned.
Hi, Dustin.
Hi, good to see everyone.